Hi, everybody, and welcome to another Keller Town Hall meeting. This is Congressman Steve Womack representing Arkansas's 3rd Congressional District. And if our people have done their jobs correctly, the people tuned in tonight hail from the 3rd District of Arkansas. And it's my pleasure, my great honor, to welcome you to tonight's telephone town hall meeting. This is an opportunity that we have periodically to share firsthand what's going on in our nation's capital. Now, one administrative note up front, to get in the queue to ask a question, all you got to do is press *3 on your touchpad, *3. And then for those of you that have not previously signed up for my weekly newsletter that we send out every Friday, all you have to do to sign up for the newsletter is press *6. So to get in the queue to ask a question tonight, it's *3. To sign up for the newsletter, just press *6. Well, it goes without saying that this has been a very historic last 10 or 12 days, beginning, of course, with the fact that we had an assassination attempt on former President Trump in Butler, Pennsylvania, but we also had what amounts to maybe a global meltdown in our servers that complicated a whole lot of things that rely on the cyber world to be able to execute their, you know, airlines, and even getting a Starbucks coffee was problematic during that meltdown this past week. And then, of course, the big news on Sunday, President Biden dropped out of his race to succeed himself as president. And then, of course, Kamala Harris, the vice president, went straight to work. And now my understanding is has received enough delegates to clinch that nomination. And so by the time they go to their convention in Chicago in August, it will be a foregone conclusion that it will be, instead of Biden-Harris, it will be Harris and whomever. I have no idea who she's going to pick. We'll probably know that here in the next several days. But those are the changes. Those are the outstanding events, the incredible events that have highlighted the last couple of weeks. And, of course, the Republican National Convention took place and got rave reviews. And now we're back to work in Washington trying to deal with the people's business. I want to say a couple of things about the assassination attempt, and then I want to talk very briefly about the appropriations process. Those of you that follow me in Congress know that I'm a senior appropriator, and I'm a subcommittee chairman. I chair the subcommittee on transportation, housing, and urban development. And we are in the midst of trying to pass the fiscal year 25 appropriation bills that should be passed and signed into law well in advance of the October 1st fiscal year beginning date, but that's obviously not going to happen, and I'll comment more about that here in just a minute. Well, let's go back about 10 days ago, the assassination attempt on President Trump. As we saw, President Trump showed incredible strength that day, continues to display that strength. I think it is appropriate to, again, talk, you know, about the innocent loss of life there that day, and our heartfelt condolences out to the family of Corey Comparator, a former voluntary fire chief who died while shielding his daughter from danger. He was dedicated to life, his life, to service and duty, and died a hero, protecting his family when those gunshots rang out. You know, we're a nation that is founded on democratic principles and political discourse, and we know that disagreement is just part of who we are as Americans. But it's never acceptable to accompany that disagreement with violence. Despite our differences, we must come together as a nation to ensure we remain a beacon of strength, freedom, and resilience, even though we may disagree from time to time on very important issues. Once again, let me say that tonight, if you want to get in the queue and ask a question, *3. If you want to sign up for my weekly newsletter, simply press *6, and you'll have an opportunity to do that. In the aftermath of the shooting, I guess it was earlier today that the chairwoman or the director of the Secret Service stepped down. That was after a debacle yesterday where she failed to answer hardly any questions from the committee. And it was a bipartisan situation yesterday where over a five-hour period of time, Director Cheadle just, failed miserably in any attempt to help the American public know exactly what happened, how it happened, and why it happened. So we still have more questions than we have answers, and those calls for her resignation rang out on both sides of the aisle, and today, of course, she stepped down. Speaker Mike Johnson is still considering appointing a bipartisan task force to investigate the assassination attempt. It would be empowered with subpoena authority and would move quickly to find the facts, ensure accountability, and make certain such failures never happen again. Let's just be clear. The Secret Service has a no-fail mission, and they failed in that mission to protect President Trump under the leadership of Director Cheadle. So she has stepped down, and the search will be on now for her replacement, and let's hope that the Secret Service can regain the respect and the dignity of that organization that it so richly has had in the past and it deserves to have going forward. Quickly, an appropriation update, and then we'll get to some phone calls tonight. This week, Congress is once again focused on trying to pass across the floor the appropriation bills that fund the discretionary part of government. Now, that's about one-third of total government spending, but it's an important part because it's the only part that Congress really votes on. The other two-thirds of government spending, as you have heard me say over and over again, is on autopilot. It's our entitlement programs, the Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, net interest on the debt, the bills that have to be paid, and that's about two-thirds of total government spending, and Congress is doing nothing about the explosive growth of the mandatory side of the budget, but instead we continue to have big food fights and disagreements over the discretionary budget of the U.S. government, which is so vital to everyday Americans. I mean, it does a lot of stuff for us. It provides for the common defense. Over half of the money we spend on the discretionary budget goes out for providing for the common defense of our country, the national defense of our nation. And then the other parts of it, fund everything from roads and bridges to national parks to cancer research and on and on and on. So that's what Congress is trying to do right now. On the floor today, and in fact on the floor right now, are a couple of those appropriation bills that we will vote on, one later tonight, and then the interior bill tomorrow. So today we've had amendments on the energy and water bill that funds the energy department, but also has an important part in national defense because that's where all of our strategic weapons are located. That's under the purview of the Department of Energy, and so the energy and water development bill is vital, is a vital piece of the discretionary budget. We will vote on that bill later. It is problematic to think that that bill is going to pass. We have a lot of people that have indicated some opposition to it for various reasons, and if we can't get this energy and water bill passed, much like we failed to do on the legislative branch subcommittee a couple of weeks ago, and maybe with Interior tomorrow, that may signal a quick and abrupt end to the House's appropriation process. We got all of our bills through committee. We've only passed, how many, Nick? Four on the floor. Again, we failed to pass the ledge branch bill. We've got energy and water tonight, Interior tomorrow. And then my bill, transportation, housing and urban development, is scheduled to be voted on next week. The problem is if we can't get energy and water done tonight and interior done tomorrow, it looks like that leadership may opt to send us early to the August recess and give us a chance to go back home and kind of recalculate our situation here in Washington. All right, with that in mind, let's take some phone calls. We're going to have a hard stop tonight about 9 o'clock Eastern time. It's right now 10 minutes after 8 o'clock Eastern, because we're going to be called to vote on some interior amendments at 9 o'clock tonight. So my day is not over by any stretch of the imagination. When this town hall concludes tonight, I will be back on the floor voting till about 10 o'clock Eastern time tonight on amendments to the interior appropriation bill. So let's take our first call. I think it's coming from a gentleman by the name of Frank in Elkins. Sir, you're on the line.
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking my call. And as I told the lady earlier, I'm approaching 72 years old. I've got 17 grandkids, and I am very concerned for their future. The budget is totally out of control. Neither party seems to be serious about doing anything about it. And I guess my question is what do you see as a solution? How do we get out of this? How do we give the next generation a future that's not riddled with debt?
Well, you know, Frank, I get that question a lot, and we're probably not going to be able to satisfy the majority of our listeners tonight on a short answer, because it's a much more deeply involved problem. You heard me say maybe right before we took your call that part of the problem with the federal budget is Congress really only deals with about a third of it. Now, we're responsible for all of it, don't get me wrong, but the discretionary budget, that's what the appropriators deal with. And I mentioned my bill, transportation, housing, and urban development. And then, of course, across the spectrum, all of the other things that we fund on a basis, that's about a third of government spending. And quite frankly, it is not the major reason why we have had a debt that has now eclipsed $35 trillion. The discretionary budget of the government, in my strong opinion, has responsibly grown over time. It hasn't experienced double-digit growth. It just is basically kept up with the level of inflation over time. For example, when I ran for office back in 2010, the discretionary budget of the U.S. government, I think, was about $1.3 trillion, and today it's about $1.6 trillion. So if you look at 14 years, and you look at those increases year over year, they're pretty much consistent with what the Fed recommended growth rate is of about 2% a year. The challenge we have, and this is the $64 question, Frank, that I think you're trying to get answered. What are the true drivers of the deficit and ultimately our debt? And while I would make the argument that it's not necessarily discretionary spending, it has a lot more to do with the fact that we have pretty much overpromised society to our people. We make things automatic in nature. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid are the big three. And now, look, I'm not advocating cutting those, but the path that they're on, as 10,000 people a day age into these programs, is not a sustainable formula. Now, these programs were built back in the 1930s and the 1960s, when the average lifespan of the typical American was somewhere in the mid to late 60s or 70-ish years of age. And now you can pick up virtually any newspaper and look at the obituary column, and consistently, people are living to 85, 90, 95, 100 years of age, and they're in these programs a lot longer than those programs were designed. So this is the challenge Congress has, and this is the basic answer to your question. Congress, and only Congress, has the ability to influence what we do or don't do as it relates to the mandatory side of the spending of the federal government. And if we're going to make changes, and they could range from cuts to programs to increased revenues to modifications to age of eligibility, means testing, I mean, you just pick from the menu of the available options, and it's only Congress that has the ability to deal with those. But it's going to have to be done through a legislative process. And most members of Congress don't want to mess with those programs for very obvious political reasons. They don't want to face the wrath of the American voter if, in fact, they are perceived to be cutting programs or, you know, adjusting programs that so many of our fellow Americans rely on, Social Security and Medicare, to be specific. So Congress is eventually going to have to do it. And here's the challenge. We don't have a mandate for it. In other words, there is no constitutional requirement to balance the budget. We don't have to balance the budget every year. If there was a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution, then the Constitution would constrain Congress from spending more than it brings in. So we're either going to have to deal with revenues or program adjustments, age of eligibility, means testing. I mean, you can go up and down that list of available options. We're going to have to deal with it because it is literally bankrupting the U.S. government. And sadly, too many people think the issue is what we're dealing with right now with discretionary amounts, and that's just simply not the case. But I do appreciate your inquiry. It's a great question, and it's a question that will continue to plague Congress until it, has the courage, can muster the courage to deal with something as sticky as these mandatory programs. All right, let's go to the next call. I think it's Murray in Tommytown. Murray, welcome.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate you taking my call, and I want you to know that I support you 100% and appreciate you standing up for us in Congress, so us Arkansasers.
Thank you so much, Murray. Means a lot.
Yes, sir. Well, my question, I came up with one listening to the last one, but I'll ask my first question, and
sure,
then I'll throw a second question and see if you have time to answer it. My first question is, with the failure of the Secret Service in protecting President Trump, do you feel like there needs to be more of the top people in the Secret Service that lose their job over this? And the Secret Service director gave them a grade of A, and I was just wondering how you felt about that. And then my final question that throws in, is there going to ever be anything done about the windfall elimination program? I know that there was a bill that didn't make it to the floor this year, and that affects a whole lot of people, especially retired Texas teachers.
Yeah, the windfall elimination. I get that. Let me go to the first part of your question first.
Okay.
And then if we have some time, and it may require me to have to get back in touch with you on the windfall program, because we're trying to take as many calls as we can. So I'll be as brief as I can. I've been involved in a number of events where there has been Secret Service protection, both here in Washington and back in my district. Anytime there is a VIP, a president, a vice president, a key member of the cabinet, those sort of, we're always going to have some kind of Secret Service, some level of Secret Service protection there. And well in advance of the date of the event, the Secret Service people are on the ground, and they are surveying the site, the routes to the site, all things considered, where the target, the VIP, could be vulnerable, could become a target, an easily accessible target. And so what the Secret Service will do is they'll send an advanced team in, and they'll work with local law enforcement, state police, county sheriffs, local city police, and they will devise a strategic plan by which they secure that area. So just imagine Butler, Pennsylvania. Former president's coming. He's got enhanced security to begin with because of threats made by the country of Iran. And so they do this, they survey this venue, and they know where he's going to be speaking from. They look at every angle, and they try to take away every potential vulnerability that they can find. Here was their challenge. There was no question that the building on which Mr. Crooks had access was less than 150 yards away from a VIP target. And they did not secure the top of that building. They may have had people in the building. They may have had people in an adjacent building. They didn't have anybody on top of that building that would have prevented Mr. Crooks from being able to gain access. And then even once he gained access, and you've seen it as many of us have, the kind of the run of events beginning a little bit before 6 o'clock and then after 6 o'clock, that there were many opportunities to either confront the individual or take that individual out of play. At some point in time, somebody failed to do something. Now, I would argue that it began on the front end with the failure to ensure that you had somebody that had eyes on that roof or physical presence on that roof that would have prevented that from happening. But who would know at the time that somebody was going to access it? And it probably would not have happened had somebody been stationed on top of that building. And I'm kind of shocked that that didn't happen because of the proximity it was and the angle that they had to the president when he spoke. So that was a failure on the very first order. Then, even after the crowd began to arrive, and then when the suspected person was identified and parading around the buildings, and you saw him on camera, they just were slow to react. So there were a number of times, a number of occasions where I think the Secret Service should have been a little more aggressive in addressing the individual who, you know, just had some questionable behavior going on around him. It didn't mean that he was automatically, you know, an individual predisposed to shooting the former president. How would you know that unless you saw him with a rifle on his back and unpacking ammunition and that sort of thing? But at the end of the day, he was a suspicious person, and there were many opportunities to do that. So the answer to your question is, should we expect more Secret Service people to resign? Possibly. I would say it could be somebody who had a lower-level supervisory position whose task it was to secure that building, top and bottom and inside and out. That it's possible, but again, we don't know those answers yet. And we didn't get those answers yesterday from Director Cheadle, and now she probably is, you know, she's already resigned, so I don't know how. We're going to have a task force to study it. Maybe those answers will come out, and maybe it will expose more leadership failures in the chain of command that are worthy of having somebody resign. But if that's not the case, then we may have to accept that Cheadle would be the only one. All right. Is this another call? All right. Murray, at some point in time, no, it wasn't Murray. Yeah, it was Murray. Murray, at some point in time, if you're still tuned in tonight, what I want you to do is call my office and let's have a longer conversation about the windfall elimination program. That would give us an opportunity to kind of go over what is possible and what is not. There are a lot of things out there that the Congress does that a lot of people would like to see changed, and the windfall elimination program is one of those, but there's a cost associated with it naturally, and because of that, it's going to require a little bit more of a detailed explanation. All right, Danny in Lowell is on the line. Danny, welcome.
Hey, welcome. Mr. Womack, it feels like I'm on the party line on your dad's radio show.
well, boy, don't we miss that.
Yeah. But my question is election integrity. As we approach elections, could you give us an insider view? I understand that you might not directly be attached to those things, but could you kind of educate us on things because there's a lot of scrutiny and a lot of questions about previous elections and their integrity. And I was wondering if you could inform us about like an insider view of things and measures that have been taken to strengthen the integrity of the elections in the future.
Yeah, well, thank you. First of all, we have, I think it's fair to point out that elections effectively are a state's responsibility. And every state in the union, conducts their own elections. There's a connective piece to the federal side because of the fact that we fund election assistance and those kinds of things, but the decision makers pretty much reside with the various secretaries of state whose purpose it is, in part, to conduct these elections. Now, let me just say this about Arkansas. I have absolute 100% confidence in John Thurston and the Secretary of State in Arkansas in the way they conduct our elections. I have no reason to believe that there's any shenanigans going on. I will admit that it is understandable, likely, that a handful of people fall through the cracks here and there. You know, we do provisional voting and that sort of thing. So it is possible that there are a few votes cast that maybe are illegitimate. But I don't think on a broader scale, on a larger scale, that it's enough to sway anyone's election. So I'm absolutely confident in what Arkansas does. What I don't want to see happen is I don't want issues, say, in another state, and you can pick one, that may have some problems to result in the federal government taking over elections and running things from the federal side. They're state responsibilities. They should be state responsibilities, and I don't want the federal government taking over our elections. Are there some things we can do to ensure that we have accuracy in voting and in these vote counts? Of course there are, particularly where it concerns the ability for a lot of these state elections to contract with and have connectivity to things like the Internet, that sort of thing, for the transmission data. Now, recently here in Congress, we passed the SAVE Act. That's just one step that we've taken to ensure that only American citizens are voting. That has not been signed into law, but we have passed it in the House. It passed earlier this month, and now we're waiting on the Senate to take up the SAVE Act. And what that would do, along the lines of election integrity, it would ensure that only Americans, American citizens, are voting in our elections, which is the way it ought to be. But there's ways around that, and we need to basically tighten that up. That's why I supported that SAVE Act when we passed that earlier this month, and now waiting on the Senate. There are other potential election integrity matters that we could take up, legislation that we could provide, funding maybe that we could provide to help strengthen and bolster and fortify these election systems. But for the most part, I kind of like I said, I like what Arkansas does, and I certainly don't want some shortcoming in a place like California or Illinois to result in Arkansas having its election system turned over to the federal government. I just would not support that. Once again, remind you to press *3 if you want to ask a question. We'll try to get to you quickly. Press *6 if you'd like to be added to our newsletter. All right, let's go to Matthew in Bentonville. Matthew, are you there?
I am. Thank you, Congressman. just real quick, I wanted to ask your thoughts about age and ability when it comes to politicians. Unfortunately, as we've seen in this election cycle in particular, there are a lot of politicians in Congress and the federal government that have stayed beyond their ability really to continue to do the job. And I have no qualms about voting for you in November. We'll do so happily. Clearly, for a man of 67, you are sharp as you've ever been intellectually, but I've watched my own father, who has 10 years on you, slow down, in the last 10 years. He could not do the job.
Okay. So you, I want to make sure I got the question right, Matthew. Are you talking about like an age limitation, a certain age that you get to where you can't serve any longer? Is that what you're asking?
It's hard to put an age on it. Just what your personal thoughts are on when, how do you know when the time has come for you to retire, that you've lost a step, and I think this is a more personal question.
Matthew, I'm glad you asked it, because it's timely right now because of what we've just been through. You know, the questions about the cognitive skills of Joe Biden, who's 81, and in his late 70s, the former president, Donald Trump, who, if is elected, will be well into his 80s at the end of that term. And let me tell you something, I'm not going to limit it just to presidential politics. You know, there are age cap laws in place for judges, and those, you know, those are constitutional. There is no constitutional provision on president, vice president, members of Congress, House, Senate, on age limitations. The only age, you just have to be a minimum certain age in order to be able to run. And that's the limit on age as it concerns members of the lawmaking body and the executive branch. I would just say this. You would think that most rational people, particularly those who have been elected to office like House, Senate, which most all of us would say call it the honor of a lifetime, that would revere that job so much so that when the time comes that they begin to slip cognitively or physically, for that matter, and can no longer, you know, manage the day-to-day routine, the travel, and all of the associated activities that go with being a member of Congress, that they would choose on their own to step aside. Now, I promise you this. You don't have to worry about me getting to a point where I'm one step away from the nursing home before I decide it's time for me to leave Congress. I will never do that to my district. I love my district too much, and I respect these voters too much. They need to have somebody who's at the top of their game at all times managing the legislative affairs of this government. And let's just be clear, there are too many issues out there that need to be addressed that require the undivided attention and the complete competency of the member. There's just no constitutional provision. And absent that, there's no way you can force somebody to get out. Maybe it should be just up to the electorate. Maybe the electorate just got to be able to collectively say that we believe this person has served long enough.
Are we there now? Okay, I've had to switch phones. For some reason, we got cut off, and I hope, Matthew, you're still there, or at least tuned in on the telephone tonight. As I was saying, and I don't know how much of this I got out, I'm not going to repeat every bit of it, but I'm just going to tell you that there's no constitutional provision that provides an age cap for members of the House and the Senate, or the executive branch for that matter. And it's pretty much left up to either the individual, and that would be my preference, to decide together with family and rational staff members who would so advise a member. And most of the time that happens. Most of the time when somebody is a little long in the tooth and they've been doing it long enough and they're losing some of their cognitive and physical ability to execute that job consistent with what the job calls for, then staffers will weigh in, family members will weigh in, and that individual should be willing to make that
that decision on their own, free of being turned out by the electorate. But in the event that that doesn't happen, and occasionally it doesn't, then it's up to the electorate to decide collectively, is this individual capable of still doing what we have elected this person to do? You want your member of Congress to be at work. You want them to be functional at work. In my strong opinion, you want that individual to be able to operate freely at work without a lot of personal attention. And too many members up here rely on their staff to take them here and there and pick their laundry up and run their chores and do all those kinds of things. I'm just not into that. And if it ever becomes necessary for me to have that kind of support, you won't have to worry about voting me out of office. I will gladly step aside. So those are the kinds of things that when you ask for my personal opinion, that's what I would say. All right. Hey, we had a poll question we sent out today via text, and I want to give it to you tonight. And you can use your touchpad to answer this question. And that is, when the Biden-Harris administration took office, remember, President Biden gave Vice President Harris the task to address the root cause of migration into the U.S. She became known as the border czar, I think is how they characterized it. So do you think Vice President Harris is an effective border czar? I think I know the answer. Press 1 for yes, press 2 for no. 1 for yes, 2 for no, and my communications team is going to be interested in seeing what the outcome of that particular poll question would be. All right, let's go to David in Bella Vista. David, are you there?
Yes, sir, and thank you for taking my call. And I first want to say thank you to you and Senator Boozman for what all you do for our veterans. And my question is military-related. With recruiting being at an all-time low, what are we doing to enhance recruiting and meeting our objectives in keeping our country safe?
Well, that's a great question, Matthew. The good news is that in my conversations with the service chiefs and the secretaries, recruiting is getting better, that we are beginning to shall we say, go in the right direction with meeting the end strength. You know, I had a lunch today with General Dan Hokanson, who is retiring as the chairman of the, or chief of the National Guard Bureau. He's on the Joint Chiefs. General Hokanson was talking about end strength today and that the Guard was going to be able to manage its end strength. And I've had conversations with the Air Force and the Navy and on, the Army. And while there may be some recruiting shortfalls, I think things are improving a little bit better. Here was part of the problem, and that is, remember, all volunteer force. So we are competing with a lot of other employers out there, a lot of other career opportunities. So as wages were trekking a bit higher, then a lot of people, and you know, and there was a lot of government programs giving away money back during COVID, and some of the people who might have a predisposition to joining the military, were just simply sitting on the sideline. So now, what have we done? We have we've given pay increases every year in the National Defense Authorization Act, and we funded those. We went a little bit further this year, in that we elevated in the last NDAA enlisted pay, and I've got my MLA and deputy chief sitting over here, Nick. That was an increase for pay for which ranks? It was O1 or E1 to E4, I think it was. Yeah, so I think we went all the way to the E4 pay category where we gave enhanced raises, and of course that will have to be signed into law, and I expect that will probably happen between now and the end of the year. So we're doing some things with special incentive pay, pro pay in some cases, as I say, E1 to E4, additional increases in the pay and compensation so that they're not poverty stricken and on food stamps. I even had legislation, because we had a special pay issue for people that were under a certain level of the federal poverty line. I had introduced legislation that would make whatever they got in that special compensation tax. Right now, if you give a special compensation out there for anything, it is automatically taxable by the federal government. Now, my bill hasn't become law, but I do think that there is a chance that we could rally support to make sure that whatever we do from a special compensation category, that we can make it tax-free, as it would be for housing or subsistence and some of the other things that that we give to our men and women in uniform. So those are some of the things that we've done, but the good news is I think recruiting is in a much better posture right now today than it was, say, a year or two ago, and we'll keep tracking it to make sure that we're doing the right thing. The last thing I'll say about recruiting, remember, so many people today, because of civil convictions or physical issues, a variety of different reasons, are just not qualified to serve in the U.S. military. And so what I don't favor is I don't favor the military lowering the standards so that more people can get in. I believe that we ought to keep a high standard and then do everything we can to help people meet and achieve those particular standards. So let's take another call. This is, what is my next call here, Nick? Is it Brian? Brian in Springdale. Brian, are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, hello, sir. I can hear you fine. Yes, sir.
Okay, great. Hey, I have two questions.
Okay.
Well, the first is kind of a comment. I'm also interested in the windfall program.
Yeah.
Because it cuts my Social Security benefits so dramatically that anyway, it's very difficult. I just would like to see some change that would improve that. I get it that I did work for a while and didn't contribute. I get that. But it would be nice. I did have plenty of quarters even before I started that other job. You know what I'm saying?
I get it. Yeah.
So it's just a little bit frustrating. And I would just like to see some change. To require 30 years of working at a high level of income then to qualify to get your full pay, that just doesn't feel fair. So anyway, I just would like to – I wish there would be somebody revisit that. That's all. But that's
yeah, well, let me tell you, I promise you this. We're going to do we're going to develop some material on the Windfall Elimination Program, the WEP as we call it. We're going to do that and have a broader conversation about it. We'll share that with everybody perhaps through our newsletter going forward.
Okay, and then second.
Yeah, go ahead.
I have a semi-truck for a living. Are you still there?
Yes, I'm here. Go ahead.
Okay, great, great. I drive a semi-truck for a living for J.B. Hunt. And so I am very interested in anything that would affect truck drivers. Like, is anything in that bill I have to do with limiting speed limitations or hours of service changes or anything like that, or is it primarily about roads? And I'm just curious what your bill has to do with on transportation.
Sure. So the transportation bill that I write covers all forms of transportation, and roads and bridges and maritime and rail and air.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I've also got the housing and urban development side, so I got both transportation and housing. One thing we've done in this bill that you will, I think, be proud of is the fact that, and this is new, and I'm not a big fan of new programs, but because of the lack of available truck parts we have around the country, and the need for us to find available parking so that people aren't just on the side of the road or stuck on some off ramp or on ramp.
Thank you.
I put 200. Listen, Brian, I've got $200 million set aside for more or less a pilot type program for truck parking in this country, in hopes that if funded, I put $200 million in there. What the Senate does is going to be perhaps a little bit lower than that, and we'll have to negotiate the final number. But what I'm hoping is that the Department of Transportation will then use that money to do some pilot programs around the country. Say, take $5, $10 million out of this pot and build a very nice truck parking facility that's got all the possible accoutrements to it that would yeah. encourage the big truckers like yourself to be able to use those rather than park in the right of way. Now we've got other
yeah. things.
We've got a livestock exemption in the bill that that I've been working on for the last several years. We have to do it in appropriations year after year because we just can't get the authorizers to do it. But I just have a fundamental belief that we should not be making our livestock haulers have to pull over on the side of the road after a certain number of hours work in order to be able to get their rest break, so to speak.
Yeah.
And because
yeah.
there's no provision in there, they're hauling live animals. Those animals have to be fed.
Right.
Those animals have to be cared for. So, I mean, we've got
right.
that exemption in there. And then there's a lot of
That's
other
good.
Things that we do in the transportation bill that that are positive for trucking. Now, as far as establishing speed limits and trucks and all of that kind of stuff, that's pretty much on the side of the authorizers in the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. And I want those guys to do their jobs. We are the funding mechanism, but occasionally we have
okay.
to do things with their funds that can kind of change their behavior, if you know what I mean. But I appreciate that.
Yeah, I thank you for working on parking because that is a nightmare. I mean, that affects, you know, I have to live with the hours of service.
Of course.
But because I can't find a place to sleep, sometimes I have to drive 2 or 3 hours less than I would normally
yeah.
be able to drive if I just had a place to go to sleep. If you understand what
yeah.
I'm saying. So, I mean,
exactly.
I drive intermodal for J.D. Hunt, and I love it. I think it's a great thing because we're saving a lot of energy and a lot of environmental impact because these things are going on the railroad. You know, 1,000
yeah.
cars on the railroad, that's huge, you know. So anyway, I feel really good about doing intermodal. But
Brian, before you get off this phone call tonight, I'm going to take a moment
yeah.
here. And if you would do this for me, take a minute here and help our listeners understand. When you say you drive intermodal, what you're talking
uh-huh.
about is, looks like an 18, it is an 18-wheeler, but you're hauling
yeah.
a container. So tell me
yeah.
how that works, where that container comes from, and then what you eventually do with that container.
So in my case, tonight, I'll take a container I picked it up at Reynolds Wrap, which is they great big plastic bags. You know, I've got a truck full of plastic. It's going to a railroad in St. Louis. St. Louis, it'll go on a railroad car, and it'll join a train that's going to carry maybe 1,000 of these types of containers. This particular one is going to go to New York, but quite often I'm taking them to. I work out of. I live in Springdale, Arkansas, but I work for J.D. Hunt, which headquarters is in Lowell, and I drive up to Kansas City. Kansas City is where a lot of the hubs are. And so they have huge booms that take these things off of the railroad, put them on our truck or semi-truck. We have a chassis that we have, and the container sits on the chassis. We lock it onto the chassis and then take it to wherever. A lot of times maybe it'll be a Walmart distribution center, for example, from Kansas City. But it will have come from California on the rail. And so there'll be, you know, a train with 1,000 of these things. Talking about saving fuel and saving the environment from all the exhaust. I mean, it's really a phenomenal thing. I'm really proud to be part of it because it's a great way to get things across the nation without having 1,000 trucks drive there. If you know what
exactly.
I mean. So
yeah,
it's a great.
And Brian, thanks for explaining that, and we appreciate your call here tonight. And look, I'm grateful to J.B. Hunt. As most of you, a lot of you know, I've known that family a long time. I knew J.B. Hunt. You know, he sadly passed away back in about 2006. But John L. Hunt's still around. I talk to her
yeah.
virtually every week. And they were one of the pioneers. the pioneer
yeah.
of the intermodal situation with regard to these containers.
I love JB.
Anyway, thank you so much for the call. Have we got another one? Oh, poll results. My staff has handed me this, and this is about what I figured it would be. Is Vice President Harris an effective border czar? Those of you that punched 1 for yes, 5%. And those of you that said no, 95%. 95-5. That's probably what I, kind of figured going in. All right, let's go to Jack in Bella Vista.
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, Jack.
Congressman, I'm fine, thanks. I was going to get you to comment on the farm bill. I'm reading where it's not likely to pass this year, and I have a feeling that's going to be a big disappointment to the farmers who are trying to plan their operations and get some stability in this, our farm programs, which have not had a new bill for quite a long time.
Well, we do one every 5 years, Jack, and not only do we not have a bill right now, but we're a year late. This farm bill was extended through the 30th of September, and there is no way there's going to be a farm bill approved between now and the end of this fiscal year. Now, that's to the chagrin of my friend John Bozeman, who is the ranking member on the Senate Ag Committee. And by the way, John Bozeman is going to be the chairman of the Senate Agriculture Committee in January. I'm convinced of that because I believe the Senate will flip and Mr. Bozeman he'll have that gavel, and I'll be anxious for him to have it. I've talked to G.T. Thompson on our side. He is the chairman of the House Ag Committee, and while he is working his tail off to try to get a bill, again, it's very problematic. Here's one of your challenges right now. For those of you that don't track this on an everyday basis, the farm bill is really more of a nutrition bill. It's about 85% SNAP. That's a food stamp program, and it's about 15 or, Nick, correct me if I'm wrong on these numbers, but we're roughly in the ballpark, about 15-18% farm bill. Now, the farm side of it does have a few challenges on reference prices and this sort of thing, but for the most part, the problematic part of the farm bill is getting bipartisan support. So we team it up with the nutrition side of the thing, SNAP, to go with farm. So in the rural areas, you get people voting for the farm bill, and then in the more metropolitan areas where there is a much more, a kind of a hesitancy on supporting farm bills, you bring those votes to the table with those members because you've got these food programs, these giveaway food programs. And so that's what puts so much hair on the farm bill. But we have between now and the end of September to figure out the way forward. My guess is they will probably punt it again, give it a short-term kick into the next year, and maybe for a full year, I don't know. But writing a farm bill in these divided government times is problematic at best. And I wish it wasn't that way, but that's just the way it is. And with that, we are smack dab out of time. I've got to go to the floor and vote. We've got amendments to the interior bill that are coming up here in about 5 minutes that I've got to get to the floor and go vote on. I'll end my day tonight. It began about 8 this morning with a visit with my New York delegation on Amtrak issues relative to my bill. My day will end tonight at about 10 o'clock on the floor of the House when we finish our vote series. And then I get to go home and do this all over again tomorrow. So now, if we didn't get to you tonight, please stay on the call, and you'll have a chance to leave a message, and we'll take those messages, and we'll staff those and get you an answer to the very best of our ability. And I promise you, we're going to do a little better job on the windfall elimination program. We know that that's that more than one person has asked about it, and you deserve to have some guidance and some direction on what, if anything, Congress is going to be willing to do. I'll just tell you straight up, there's a cost associated with it. And for those that are concerned about deficits and debt, you certainly would be interested in knowing exactly what the cost would be. And maybe that's a CBO sort of question that we can get answered. But you guys have been terrific tonight, as always. It's a great honor and a privilege to serve you in the 3rd District of Arkansas. I'm just proud every day of what we're able to do in our district. We're growing. We're developing. I think Washington could take a lot of cues from the great things that are happening in Arkansas's 3rd. And that's not just Benton and Washington County, where a lot of this major growth is, but I'm talking about what's going on in the Valley, too, Fort Smith, Van Buren, out in those areas. The excitement that we have coming later this fall with the F-35 mission that's going to be there at Ebbing Air Force Base, and a host of other things that are good for not only our economy, but for jobs and for the quality of life that kind of distinguishes our area from all others. So thank you so much. It's been an honor and a privilege to be with you again this evening. I'll head to the floor and go vote. In the meantime, you have a great night, and we'll talk to you again soon. Good night, everybody.